want to... So we have the two recordings. So you know what? Maybe save 2 inches of introduction for people listening over the world, so they should know where, say where we are, the date.
For people listening over the world, today is August 7th. Boker Tov to everyone, August 7th, 2016. You always say 2017, though. All right, still 2016.
Here, give the right date.
It's the third of Menachem of Tovshin Ayin Vav. I'm delighted to welcome Rabbi Dr. Aaron Rakefet to B'nai Yeshurun, Congregation B'nai Yeshurun in Teaneck, New Jersey, for this lecture on the topic of the role of Minhag and the mistake of the conservative and neoconservative movements. Rabbi Rakefet is a Rebbe of thousands, now going back many decades, maybe the longest now tenured professor on the faculty of Yeshiva University. And his years in Chinuch and Harbatzas Torah should continue in good health and good strength. I number myself among his Talmidim. I mentioned yesterday, exactly 40 years ago, I sat in his shir, and Rav Rakefet is one of the last remaining people, so call me the Pruz, and for that I appreciate it as well. So to Chavod Gadol, I present Rabbi Dr. Aaron Rakefet.
I'm from a different type of Rabbanim. Covered and fancy titles are very distant from me. I had a lot of fortune in my first misfortune because I was, in my days, they kicked you out of the yeshiva at the age of 23. There were no kolam. Either you knew how to learn or you were finished. So I was kicked out at 23 and I was a hot shot at Talmud of the Rav. I knew how to learn it. Two masters already, working for my doctorate. I went into my first rabbinate and I got killed. And Meir Kahana, I write about it in Washington, I've spoken about it. He did not survive his first rabbinate where they kicked him out in the middle of the night. And Meir became mayor. He always had difficulty being a team player. But after his first rabbinate, he could never be a team player again. And it actually cost the Jewish people a future prime minister. Of course, Meir had the ability, had he only accepted Menachem Begin's offer when he came in Aliyah for a safe spot on the Likud ticket, the history of our people might have been different. My first rabbinate, as I said yesterday, was re-elected by 9-7, a Pyrrhic victory. But it took away my ego. Took away any desire for kavod. It left me just with one desire in the world, to know Kol HaTorah Kula. I haven't achieved it, but no one can accuse me of not trying. What do you say, Gadal? You're right or wrong?
Right.
Okay. Baruch Hashem, I'll pay you after it. It's too bad that we can't record the Shiurim on Shabbos. Actually, in Beverly Hills, they wanted to bring a goyim to record, and they were serious. I told them, look, I can't do it. There are limits to kulat that we can agree to. But this shayua follows what we spoke about yesterday very briefly. The halacha, you know, if there can be uniformity in halacha, hashkafa. And then we come to minhag. And I come back to the hakdama of the Rambam to Mishneh Torah, the hakdama of the Rambam to Mishnayot, Seder Zrayim. The Rambam talks about Torah Shebaal Peh. Torah Shebaal Peh, you all know there's a written Torah and an oral Torah. The written Torah we have no problem defining. We lay in it in Shabbos yesterday, I think we have. Is it the longest laying possible? Yeah, the longest laying possible yesterday. Was that near
244?
I know, it was near 250, 244 to be exact. Too bad you didn't have one of my grandsons here, would have done it in 20 minutes. But he's far from here right now. No, the laning was the Matot Masai. That was the problem. It's wow. Okay. But the written Torah we know. What is the oral Torah? So the Rambam gives three divisions that comprise the oral Torah. The first two are very easy to define. Gezeirot v'takanot. Minhag, the third one, the Steichemet raised his hands already. That was the great Rav of Gavron 180 years ago, 170 years ago. And the Steichemet, Rav Chaim Chizkiyahu Medini, And if you're familiar with the Steichemet, it's an encyclopedic work that's valuable until today, because he quotes periodicals, journals that don't enter the Bar Ilan computer. And he raised his hands and said, very difficult to define Minhagim. All right, let's begin with Takanot and Gezerah. A Gezerah is from Kite. I would say two-thirds of our practicing Yiddishkeit is based upon a Gezerah. A simple example, how many sets of dishes? My cousin is sitting here. I can guarantee you he has two sets of dishes. I know the family he comes from, my wife comes from. My wife has kumris with kashrut, where she covers up the knobs of the sink. You never saw it in your life. And she says her grandmother did it. That's your grandmother's, your great aunt, if I'm not mistaken. Correct? So we can really have one set of dishes. According to the Torah, use the dishes, leave them stand idle for 24 hours. So even that you can get away with a little, but 24 hours. You can use it afterwards. Tam lifgam, whatever it's absorbed is minuscule now. But the Chachamim made a gezeira. We have to have separate dishes. Even after 24 hours, you can't use meat for milk dishes. We spoke about it yesterday. Today everyone is told to eat chicken, not to eat meat. No, you can eat chicken, baste it in sour cream. What's wrong? Butter, cheese and chicken. Go to McDonald's, I get a kosher McDonald's, cheese and chicken. And it's a gezeira d'rabbanan, right or wrong, that you can't have chicken and milk together. It's a rabbinic law. People will confuse. Shabbos, what's the first thing you teach little children? I remember when my grandsons were like 2-3 years old, they come to me with shaylos, can they play this game? Muktzah, muktzah, muktzah. Otherwise, there's what else? A kid, you know, doesn't do anything Shabbos. He's eating, drinking, happy, getting lollipops and shul. But when he wants to play with a game that makes noise, music, muktzah, muktzah, zikazay, or the rabbanan. According to Torah law, I can pick up a pen. I just can't write with a pen. But if you pick it up, you write. So it's a gezerah. Tarat mishpacha, shivinikiyim. Again, I can't go into detail here because it would take me a half hour. But the whole concept of every woman counting 7 days after the initial five, minimum of five, is a gezerah that the women themselves made, according to the Gemara in Nida. So a gezerah means frumkeit, a fence around the Torah. Fine. Takana is just the opposite. At times it goes against the Torah, but it's for the good, the welfare, economic, social, mental welfare of the Jewish people. I'll give you a simple example. I used this example in Machon Gold in 71, I believe it was. And I said to the class, what would you girls do? And these were older, you know, then you came to Israel much older, either a junior in college or after college. And I said, what would you do if you're going out with a boy and the boy says to you, Susie, I love you, I want to marry you. But look, it's after the Holocaust. We lost 3 million Jewish children. I wish to marry you on condition I can have 3 other wives. Because with one wife, I can have 5, 6, 7, 8 children. With 4 wives, I can produce 30, 40 Jewish children. What would you say? No, for the good of the Jewish people, that's a beautiful marriage proposal. One girl raised a hand, and I remember who I don't want to say. She said she would accept it. And that girl is no longer religious. So it was the ones who wouldn't accept it who remained within, thank God. Her brother is a Yidat Tzaddik, lives in Yerushalayim, but she raised her hand, beautiful. She was mesmerized by a foolish question. But Rabbeinu Gershom made a gezerah, I shouldn't say gezerah, made a takana that we can't have more than one wife. It's for social reasons. It's society has changed. Marriage is just more than to have children. I don't have to explain to you what's happened today. Even the Sfardim, after 1950, the chief rabbinate in Israel renewed the gezerah for all Jews, Ashkenazim and Sfardim, living in the state of Israel. So, you see, that's the gezerah, that's a takana If I say gezeira now, I mean takana. Correct me. The Rav used to say lulav and make the net rog there, so it's, if the audience would correct them, it'd say I want to see if you're still awake. That was my Rebbe's comment there, so always correct me, because the mind runs ahead of the mouth. I'll give you another example. Anyone who's Hasidish here knows on Shabbos you have to have fish. Al pi Kabbalah, fish are very important because they didn't sin. Fish survived the flood. Right or wrong? No, the Gentiles knew that the Jews have to need fish, so they raised the price. You'll find already in the original Tzemach Tzedek, not the one I quoted yesterday, but it's Rav Krachmal, it's from an earlier period, from the 1700s. In his time, they made a takana, no one should buy fish till the prices come down. And they forced the Gentiles that on Thursday, you can't overcharge, or we'll do away with fish, with the Kabbalah, we're not going to pay a fortune. That's a takana for the economic good of the Jewish people. When it comes to minhag, it's very amorphous, very nebulous. What is a minhag? Okay, we have a klal in the Gemara. It's both referred to in the Bavli, even more clearly in the Yushami. If anyone wants, it's Yushami, Bab Metzia, Perek Zayin, what we call Halacha Aleph, minhag mevatel halacha. Now, what does this mean? People quote it, a minhag can cancel halacha. What it means is very simple. In monetary matters, the Torah did not demand obedience. It's not like Issa v'Cheta, like Kashrut, like Shabbat, not like the laws of marriage and divorce. In monetary matters, there is a concept that in addition to what the Torah ordained, local custom also determines law. And the example in Bab Metzia, let's say in a certain area, you hire workers. And the Balabas says, look, I'm hiring you to work from sunrise to sunset. And that's what the Torah really means. You hire a worker. He has to work a full day. What about if the local custom is you only work 8 hours a day? During the summer months, it's a lot less than from sunrise to sunset. That custom is halachically binding. And when you hire workers and you say to them, I want you to work a full day, the full day can be determined not just by what the Torah originally said, but by the local custom. Give you a more powerful example. It's also a Gemara in Bav Metzia. It's in Chayshin Mishpat. It's actually in the, if you go into New York State Court, you'll find this example right there as a ruling by the court. We have a lawyer sitting here, my dear Talmud, your rabbi, and he will certify what I'm saying. The Gemara talks about a kinyan. It has to do with buying wine. I'll give you the exact word the Gemara uses. It's the Gemara Bav Metzia, Daf Ayin Dalet Amud Aleph, Situmta. Situmta. What does Situmta mean? The Jews in the Middle Ages engaged in very, very heavy trade in wine. Manufacturing, selling, trading. A classmate of mine has become the greatest expert on wine manufacture, Middle Ages, halacha. His magnum opus was published about 3 years ago. It's the gold star in Chochmat Yisrael, in scientific Jewish scholarship today. Can anyone tell me his name? You think I had the only classmates who were dummies? I had some classmates who were very bright. His name, Chaim Soloveitchik, Chaimka, the Rav's son. Chaim's work, it's called Jainam, wine. So look what happens. I manufacture wine. All right, he deals with all the problems. You have to hire goyim to stomp on the grapes. Knew the minute you hire goyim to stomp on the grapes, it's a whole question. The goyim are touching the wine, the juice coming out. Is it kosher? Isn't it kosher? You're now shipping the wine in sealed caskets. Maybe the guy can pry it open and drink a little, put a straw in. He deals with all these questions, and the manufacture and total mastery of Torah literature and general literature, Chaim is one of a kind. So now you're buying, the caskets have arrived, and you buy 25 caskets of wine, which you're gradually going to sell. Are those caskets yours? According to the Gemara, you have to do Mashiach. You have to pull the caskets. Who can pull 25 caskets of wine? So Rashi, who was in the wine business and lived in an area where the Jews engaged in wine, he describes that if I would buy 25 caskets, they would write on the caskets of wine AR. Not Rodriguez, but Rakefet. Okay? Aaron Rakefet. No, the Torah never discussed that. But if that's the local custom, it's yours. You don't have to pull it. At that moment, it becomes yours. If a fire breaks out and destroys all the wine, it's your loss, not the seller's loss. Are you with me? Now, you know, this translates in modern times, what reached the New York courts. How many of you have bought a diamond ring or some jewelry in the 47th Street area? No? What happens? Mazel u'bracha. You shake hands. A Afro-American made a deal with a Hasidic Yid. They both work in the area. And they shook hands, mazel u'bracha. And then the Hasidic Jew wanted to break the commitment. He got a better price. The Afro-American said, no, we agreed. That's the price. I didn't write it down. You don't have to write it down. Everyone in 47th Street says, mazel u'bracha, that people borrow hundreds of thousands of dollars, transfer hands on mazel u'bracha. So the Hasidic Jew said, yeah, but you're an Afro-American. You're not a Hasidic Jew. It went to court, and the judge ruled that mazel u'bracha is final. It ends the acquisition. This is what goes on in 47th Street. And he can be an Afro-American, but he works there. He knows what goes on. He probably speaks a better Yiddish than anyone here under 50 years of age. And therefore, mazel u'bracha. So you see, this is a minhag. And a minhag becomes very, very important. Now, there's a big sugya in Yerushalmi Yevamot. I can't go into the whole sugya, but I can give you the highlights, and then I want to quote the most famous words in this Gemara. When a daughter of a Yisrael or a Levi marries a Kohen, she's allowed to eat truma. The slaves who work for a Kohen are allowed to eat truma. What happens if the Kohen dies and his wife is pregnant at the time with their first child? And slaves survive the owner. Can they still eat truma? The question is, that baby in the mother's womb, is he like a living Kohen or is he dead? Can he empower the slaves to eat truma because the lady is pregnant with a child who will be a Kohen? Well, no, if he isn't alive yet, the father is dead, he's not alive yet, he cannot give and grant that right to the slaves. And here the Gemara says, go out and see what the minhag is. And the Gemara uses the words, kol halacha shehid of fefet bebeitin, v'eina ta yodeya mativa, tse ure'e echad siba noheg v'nachug. And the Gemara says on that question, see what the people are doing. Here, we don't know what the Paskin, we can see it either way. You can make a case. This baby is alive. He's going to be born. He's going to be a Kohen. He's going to inherit the slaves. Why can't the slaves not eat truma? Or you can make a case. What do you mean he's going to be alive? He's not born. He doesn't walk. He doesn't talk. He doesn't speak. He's not breathing air. These slaves can't eat yet. Let's see what happens. Let's wait 9 months. No, you don't know. So Gemara says, Rofefet, when you don't know, when you're in doubt, go out and see what the people are doing. This thing repeats itself on one of the most important aspects of life. This is a Gemara in Brachat, Daf Mem Daled Amid Bet, Mem Hei Amid Aleph. I have water in this cup. Water is the most important aspect of what we eat, drink. Our body is, what is it, 85% water? What do you say, Dr. Berger?
65%.
How much? How much?
Two-thirds.
So what's it? 67%. I was raised 82%. I don't know. I guess biology has undergone revisions. Without water, we can't survive. You know, some of my grandchildren have taken survival courses in preparation for the army. And of course, they teach them if you're stuck in a desert, if you're stuck on a mountain, how you can eat leaves, how you can squeeze leaves and get some water. A person has to have water. Okay. If that's the case, what is the most important aspect of what we eat? So the Gemara was a whole machloket, what bracha do you make on water? Do you make a simple shahakob bracha, or because water is so important, before you drink water, borei nefashat rabak, you should make the longer bracha on water. And there the Gemara says, fuk chazi mai amar devar. We don't know how to paskin. Go out and see what the people are doing on the streets. And they went out, they looked around, and they saw that Am Yisrael makes a shahako before they drink and a burn of fashet after they drink. And that became the halacha which we observe since time immemorial, shahako boring of fashet. So you see, they're minhagim and minhagim. Sometimes it's not clear, we're in doubt. But Am Yisrael determines the ultimate practice of a minhag. And there are many examples, halacha l'maisa, every lady here lights Shabbat candles. No, where did you see in the Torah that you're commanded to light Shabbat candles? It began as part of Kibud V'Yoneg Shabbat, enhancing the Sabbath, which is certainly it borders on a Torah law. It's Divrei Kabbalah. Well, in their homes at that time, there was no electricity, so you had to light Shabbos candles to come home, have light, Onig Shabbat, be able to make Kiddush, to eat, to learn, to open a chumash. Okay. All right, then, how many candles do you light? You all know, various minhagim. Basically, we light two candles, a chavishama. Many people have the minhag to light many candles for each child. The Gerer Rebbetzin, there's a website called Bolamam Shel Charedim. It's a fascinating website, but difficult. If you love Torah, there's never any good news on it. I know the person who puts out the website. His first marriage was to my student. She kicked him out a year later. He wound up in Brooklyn. When they tried to kill him in Brooklyn, he ran right to Florida. But his website has had, I think it's over 40 million hits. So it's no Lashon Hara, it's Tavi Yadua L'Rabim. But he has informers in every Haredi sect. And you'll see on his website, the Gera Rebbetzin lit two candles in Bnei Brak this past Friday. By the way, there's a price on his head in Gera, because they think he's paying off someone from within. So you would wonder, what is it? What does it matter? The Gera Rebbetzin lit two candles on Friday? What's the big deal? What's the gossip? Why does everyone want to see it on a website? Because the Gera Rebbe, so Zayin Gesund, has two residences, one in Bnei Brak, one in Yerushalayim. So there was Chassidim were always curious where he spends Shabbat, because the more he spends in one residence, that shows it's his real residence. So all the years she lit endless candles in Bnei Brak for every child, could be every grandchild. I mean, Ger is Ger. They don't lack money. They can afford to buy endless candles, if you understand what I'm saying. They're not poor Rebbeim. They never take a penny for themselves. They visited Israel. This Rebbe's grandfather, the Re'im, Rebbe Avraham Mordechai, visited Israel about 6-7 times between in the interbellum period. Each time he visited, he bought real estate. So the Gera Rebbeim do not take pigeonim or pigeonot. When a chassid sees him, lehefet. If you ever went into the Gera Rebbe, during the winter there's a big carton of apples at his side, and he gives everyone an apple. During the summer, it's oranges, and every chassid walks out with an orange. The only money they raise is for their school system, the yeshivat, of course. So she would lighten Bnei Brak endless candles. When he stayed Shabbat in Yerushalayim, two candles. It was big news about 2 years ago. Yerushalayim gets endless candles, Bnei Brak only two. But you see, this is a minhag. It's not a halacha, it's not a Torah law. It's a minhag. If you want to light two, you want to light more. It could very well be, and I don't want to get in trouble with the women, but Rav Heschel Schechter once said, I have said it privately before, he said it publicly, and a lot of women were upset with him, that Bizman Hazel, lighting candles, plays no purpose. You should light Shabbos candles, the electricity. What are you lighting for? To give light, to light up the house. Who needs candles? You have to turn off the electricity, make a bracha, and then turn the Shabbos electricity on. So I want to propose a compromise, because a woman said, he's taking away my most precious mitzvah. So I have a simple compromise. Before you light the Shabbos candles, turn on the lights, make the bracha, and light the Shabbos candles. It's min yotzei l'chol hadeos. Yotzei according to everyone. I'll give you another example, and this is a toughie. We Jews, Torah Jews, by the way, I never use the word Orthodox Jews. That's a misnomer. We should never use it. Our enemies planted it on us, that we're narrow-minded, Orthodox in Latin. We are Torah Jews. There's no such thing as Reform, Conservative. You want to be a Jew? There's only one way to be a Jew, with Shabbos, Kashrut, Tarat, Mishpacha, the way we have lived since Matan Torah, and that's the only way there'll be Jews tomorrow. And I don't have to tell you, the Pooh Report said exactly what I said, and if the New York Times can quote the Pooh Report, so it shows Emes V'Yatzev, amazing how few people became frumer from the New York Times as a result of the Pooh Report. But it's what we spoke about yesterday, the gentilized American Jew, plain and simple. So, we're normal people. We have normal rituals. A woman once walked into shul, this is, I remember, on the Israeli television in the 70s, when the Baal Chilvamut was first beginning. She came in on Yom Kippur, and she said, oh, what a terrible religion. And they asked her, what happened? All day people are clapping chait and sit, talking about their sins. This is religion. So someone should have said to her, one day a year, look at the other 364. No, there's one day a year an outsider would walk into a shul, miklapt hoshanis. No, what am I talking about? Everyone comes in with five branches, the Arafat, and suddenly everyone is banging on the floor. What? When? Where? The Gemara says, minig neviim, that this is an ancient, ancient minhag. No, when do you clap hoshanis, I ask you? The various minhagim, before, after, the kaddish, right or wrong. Oh my God, it's not the end of the world. Do according to your minhag. By the way, if anyone will ask you, and I always tell my grandchildren, could you imagine some outsider walked into shul, wants to see what Torah is all about, and what does he see that day? Meklapt hoshanis. But I tell you, it's not so strange. I'm breaking into Yiddish, my apologies, but when I live Torah, I live it in Yiddish. When I learned in Lakewood, they convinced me that the Torah was given in Yiddish. And I believe it until today. I have to be honest with you. I remember saying, Freddie Zucker, once again, who I quoted yesterday, he died young from Baltimore. Freddie saying to me, "Fi can't assign on to this. Moshe Rabbeinu nishkid at Yiddish with the Ribbono Shel Olam. How can it be different?" So I explained to my grandchildren, if we Edmunduch macht Elul, the Yelef das Elul daf sign, if you go through Chodesh Elul like Elul should be, getting ready, and then Rosh Hashanah and Aser Jemei Shuv and Hilchot Shuv of the Rambam, and then you're busy with the Lulav and Etrog and the Sukkah, it's a tense period. At the end already, Sukkot is ending. All we have left now is Shmini Atzeres, Simchas Torah. We want to get rid of all our tensions. It's like physical therapy, okay? So you can explain it. All right, so my dear friends, I can go on and on with examples of Minhag. Where I want to shift gears now. Where the tragedy begins, in 1902, Jacob Schiff, who had grown up on the lap of Reb Shimshon Fol Hirsch, and was a wonderful Jew, but came to America, and America influences. And here you have a man who was president of Temple Emanuel, and observed Kashrut, benched, observed Shabbos to a certain degree, Seder, Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur. This was Jacob Schiff, the father of Dorothy Schiff, the publisher of the New York Post when I was growing up. Well-known family. And he decided, and an interesting individual, can tell you a true story, that one time during the week, they're coming to daven in the Beis Medrash HaGadol on Norfolk Street. This has to be like 130 years ago. And they see a big carriage outside with the horses and a driver. They come into the shul. There's Jacob Schiff, Talis, Tfillin. They asked him, "Mr. Schiff, you're the president of Temple Emanuel. What are you doing down on the Lower East Side?" And he answered, "Today I have yahrzeit for my mother. I should hold the yahrzeit in a reformed temple." This was Jacob Schiff. In 1902, I mentioned this, I believe, in private conversation over the weekend, not in public. JTS, Jewish Theological Seminary, was about to close. Their graduates had no future. The East European immigrants looked at them, that these are Rabbanim, these are Rabbanim, they can't nisht learn, and what, they learned 30 daf gemara in a year, what we learned in a week in Europe. Couldn't accept them. The Reform couldn't accept them because they were observant in practice. So Mr. Schiff said, "Look, we have to have an," I'm quoting him now, "we have to have an enlightened orthodoxy." That was his term. And he said, "We have to bring over a scholar who will put JTS back on the map." And he brought Solomon Schecht to America. Now, Solomon Schecht, the Schnur Zalman Schecht, you see from the name Schnur Zalman, we're talking about a Chabadnik. His father was a Sheikhet, that's how you get the name Schechter. His father was the Sheikhet for the Sholem Meshiv, for Reb Shol Yosef Nathanson was a great Rav. Ah, and this was his son. And Solomon Shechter had broadened. It's like he went to Bernard Revel Graduate School. He had a PhD. He edited the text of Avot the Rebbe Natan. And he was a frum person, came to America. And you see, this is the secret of remaining a Jew. I heard this from the Rav 1,000 times. I've repeated it tens of thousands of times. Avraham Avinu says to the Hittites, Ger v'toshav anochi imachem. We have a dual existence. On one hand, ger, we're different. We're different than the non-Jews. How can a non-Jew understand what Kashrut is about, what Shabbat is about, what Tarat Mishpacha? Go and explain to Bill Clinton Tarat Mishpacha. Okay? It's frightening who our examples are, because these are who the kids look up to. We're different. On the other hand, we're not different. If you scratch me, I bleed. If you scratch President Obama, he bleeds, right or wrong. We're human beings. Have a grandson, have a number of grandsons in the Technion. So one grandson is 7 years already. He did Hezder, and he was a Chovesh Kravi, and he saw blood in battle. So when he finished 5 years of Hezder, he says to me, I don't know what to do, Saba. I don't know what to study. I told him, look, you saw blood in battle. You told me you can handle it. Why don't you become a medical doctor? I always tell them first to become a Rebbe. But all right, no one's interested. They want to make a living. Okay. So he got into the Technion. And they have a special program. At the end of 3 years of genius ability, they invite you into what's called an MD, PhD program, where you have to do research for the next 20 years. You can't practice. You get an MD, you get a PhD. What this kid is doing research, he went to visit multi-million dollars worth of equipment made in Germany, especially for them, and he works with cells. And don't ask, and his professor is world famous, so he was a Nobel Prize candidate. There are four people working there. Interestingly enough, three women and my grandson. It's interesting, women in research in Israel are very big. There's a Rosh Yeshiva's wife who they say one day will win a Nobel Prize. She's at Tel Aviv, you research something with cancer. And unbelievable, these kids. No, and I tell him, you know, the Technion, you don't have any expenses. They give you an apartment, they give you an allowance. All they want you to do is research. He married a classmate who's a regular doctor. She can practice. So I said to him, you have to win a Nobel Prize to pay them back. No, if there's a breakthrough against cancer, we're not going to be the only ones who rejoice. If I'm not mistaken, every person who walks the face of the earth should rejoice. The vaccines against polio, right or wrong, what would two Jews accomplish for the world? Why still new kids who couldn't walk properly? They had polio in their youth. Norman was my classmate. You know what I'm talking about. These are breakthroughs. So you see, we have a dual existence. But the challenge to us is to differentiate between the ger and the toshav. I cannot allow the toshav aspects to influence my religious commitment. The Vah Hashem Zu Halacha. I always tell my students, my children, grandchildren, etc. I can already talk with some of my great-grandchildren. You must never let alien ideas influence your thinking. We grow up democracy. One day there'll be Malkut Beit David. So some jerk will yell, I heard a lecture from Aaron Rakefet 2,000 years ago and he was saying how great democracy is and how it changed the face of Israel. Correct. But when Mashiach Tzidkenu comes, Malchut Beit David, no two ways about it. Forget about your toshav ideas of democracy. Simple example. Feminism. Feminism, how badly that affected the Torah people is indescribable. Solomon Schechter was a from Jew, but 100 years ago, Virginia Slims smoked in public, and she was not arrested. Women went to high school. Women went to college. Women came into the synagogue, and by the way, you can read my book on Revel. I cite sources. It's not secrets. There are other volumes by the conservative movement. What, we have to sit behind the wall? We're second-rate citizens. We're just like men. We now have the vote. Rav Avram, you know, Rav Avram Yitzchak Cohen Cook was opposed to women having the right to vote. He had been in Switzerland, and in Switzerland, women didn't vote until modern times. Women don't have the right. I had my way. The Rakefet plan, only women should be in the Knesset. 120 women. Men have to learn Torah. It's Bitul Torah. Women are obligated to learn Torah. They can run the country. And by the way, the greatest women are running the country. Ayelet Shaked, Miri Regev, Gila Gamliel, and these are all Shomeret Shabbat women. Kala Kavaldi. Not the one from Mizrahi. She claims she's Chilonit. Ayelet Shaked. We'll never know, because you have never seen who her husband is. Can anyone tell me why? Ayelet Shaked, my granddaughter has a picture on the wall. She visited her Ulpana, and my granddaughter had a picture taken with Ayelet Shaked. We love her. No, why not? Her husband is a pilot in the IDF. A pilot's picture cannot be published. Okay, Baruch Hashem. Solomon Schechter made a tragic mistake. He allowed the Toshav to influence the Ger. And he permitted mixed seating. Now, who would ever dream permitting mixed seating in 1915, what that would lead to in the next 100 years? He had to justify it. So he quoted the very Gemara that I quoted 1 minute ago. Fukhazi mai ama devar. Go out and see what the people are doing. No, look at the Jews on the street. The women and men, totally integrated. Why can't we have integration? Look, the people want it. He coined a whole theory. Anyone can tell me the name of his theory? When I was a kid, I used to shudder. I had Catholic Israel. So I thought it meant Jews should be Catholics. No, Catholic in Latin means universal. He coined the theory the universal Jewish people are the ultimate arbiters of the halacha. That is a tragic mistake. Yeah, the universal Jewish people are the ultimate arbiters. When we don't know what the halacha is, rofefet, quoting the Yerushalmi, we're not sure. And also, who do you look to determine? It's Jews who care, Jews who make a bracha, Jews who say shahako, Jews who say borei nefashat. And wow, did that theory ultimately, from an institution that began as an authentic Jewish institution in loyalty, read their preamble, their charter in 1887. Loyalty and fealty to the written Torah, to the oral Torah, to the aspirations of the Jewish people throughout the millennium. A constitution that all of us could sign on. And look what happened to the conservative movement today. And it began slowly. Mixed seating. All right. The women are happy. Equal to the men. Yontif Sheni. Your rabbi, my Talmud, said to me afterwards, and I told him, you're absolutely right. I discussed it with the rabbi. I asked Rebbe, remember what we said about Yontif Sheni yesterday? So I asked Rebbe if the Chacham Tzvi is right. Why do we tell people to observe a day and a half l'chumra? The middle shita. So the Rav said, out of covet for the Shulchan Aruch. So I said to Rabbi, I have a second reason. that when a kid is in Israel, when he sees there's no Yontif Sheni or people visiting, they can come back to America and start thinking, well, the tzaddikim in Yerushalayim, what? If Rabbi Rakefet doesn't observe a Yontif Sheni, I can also dismiss Yontif Sheni, even though I'm in America. So you have to be very careful that you have to understand there's Israel, there's America, there's an understanding of why we have this division. But once you start to let the people rule, the people who don't care, then the conservative movement, remember their famous ruling, this already was in the 30s, that if there's a Yontif Sheni minyan, don't abolish it. But if the rabbi has trouble making a Yontif Sheni minyan, you do not need it because we have a calendar today. Then you go further, wine. What's wrong with wine? Bring in, I don't know, growing up, Gallo Brothers wine. Does that still exist? Gentile wine. Pour me a glass of Gallo. What's wrong? It's grapes. No? So you remember their ruling? The one that was accepted by the conservative movement for purposes of sanctification, you use kosher wine to make Kiddush. Havdalah. But outside of moments of sanctity, you can drink any wine. All right. Another break. But the ultimate break, of course, came in 1953 when three rabbanim who were all raised in yeshiva. Teddy Friedman was an MTA graduate who went to JTS. Jacob Agus was a Talmud Mufak of Reb Moshe Soloveitchik, and my cousin Reb Dov Revel, a Talmud Mufak, and Adler, who's later killed in the pulpit, what was it, 66, in Detroit, in his synagogue, where a 16-year-old kid shoots him in front of the whole congregation, Morris Adler. His father was the Rosh Yeshiva of MTJ, Mesifta Teferet Yerushalayim, before Reb Moshe. And they permitted riding to the shul on Shabbos. My dear friends, we have to be very careful when it comes to the Baruch Hashem. Let me go just one step further and conclude. At this very moment in time, some of my very students are involved. Some of Reb Aaron Lichtenstein, Zeichet Tzadik Levracha, my dear, dear friend, colleague, Reb Aaron Lichtenstein, the babe as we knew him, anyone from yeshiva. You know that I got a call from very serious people, scholars, calling me from Yenemsvelt in America. Why was he called the babe? And some idiot told them that he was called the babe because he was like Babe Ruth. Babe Ruth was one of a kind. And Aaron Lichtenstein, I said, oh my gosh, the babe was called the babe because he had a big, round, baby face. When he was a kid, 40, I've known from 51 on. Not when you're in old age. I have a grandson has exactly the babe's face. Halavai should have his mind, his intellect. He was called the babe, a big baby face. Babe Ruth could be later. The Reb Aaron was a big baseball fan. He was. I eulogized him. If you heard my eulogy in Yerushalayim, everyone would come in. I was the only one who was a friend who knew him as a Talmud Chaver. So I showed the human aspects. I said, with his death, it's the last person alive who could give you the starting lineup of the Chicago Cubs the last time they were in the World Series in 1945. And that's an absolute fact. Aaron knew the exact lineup. So his Talmud are involved. Then they quote the Rav. It breaks our heart. What developed today, feminism in Yerushalayim, Shira Chadasha, they began, after all, a woman can be called to the Torah and open Gemara at the end of Megillah. It's not covered Hatzibur. And you know what that means, it's not covered Hatzibur. That davening is a man's function, the public function of a man. A woman may very well be obligated to daven twice a day. Could the Rabbi Mori Rebbe's daughters daven three times a day, I can tell you. But the Chafetz Chaim already was lenient for a woman who has to run a family and children and a house, so she says one tefillah a day. But to If men can't do the Torah, it's an insult to men that we're ignoramuses, we're boors, we have to call upon the Chamaledowich to save us. It's an insult to men. So suddenly a new world. No, today the men don't want, and the minig is different. So in Shira Chadash and Yerushalayim, Gutzal Uphitten, and who founded it, the daughter of a person who studied first in Lubavitch, and then in Chaim Berlin, and then in Lakewood, and then with the Rav, and then in Fordham University. And that was already the blowout. And all right, Kohen Levi Yisrael. Then three women get an aliyah, and then 1 week, if the woman is the seventh, the man is maftia, or vice versa. And the woman reads from the Torah, it is beyond description. Then they started, why only reading from the Torah? Why can't the woman daven for the tzibur? Tell me, maybe we should require men to go to mikveh once a month. You understand what I'm saying? A man has his obligations, a woman has hers. So then they started, l'chuna ranana, l'chad daldi, it's not part of the davening, a woman can lead the service. Then she led the service. 2 years ago already, that's exactly the conservative movement before our eyes, the neoconservative movement before our eyes. A woman already, tfilat marav is reshut, not chovah. It's not obligatory originally. Why can't the woman lead the davening? Shira Chadasha, a woman, barchu, singing, dancing. Let me tell you a little story, bididi haviyuvda. Not as dumb as you think. Very important, world-famous people invite us. All right, we're sitting in Yerushalayim in a sukkah with members of the Board of Trustees of Yeshiva University, and there's some women there who are putting the needle in, and he turns to me. I don't want to mention his name. He's a fabulous individual, but okay. Rabbi Rakefet, suddenly I became rabbi. He knows me as Ani. We go back to yeshiva time immemorial. Rabbi, tell me, why can't women leave? What are you so upset about? L'chuna ranana, l'cha dodi. So I said to him, and this is based upon something the Rebbe said in court in the Mount Clemens issue over the Mechitza in the mid-50s. I said, whatever his name is, I'll call him Johnny, so we'll avoid any identity. Johnny, tell me, if a 29-year-old woman is leading the L'chad Dodi and singing in Kalbach tune and she's in ecstasy and jumping around, are you looking at her or at your sitter? If you're not looking at her, you're not a man. And if you're not looking at your sitter, you're not a Jew. Think about it. God, this is world. God gave us a certain world. So one has to be very careful. So let me summarize and let me conclude and lead into the new book. Obviously, everything I've said over Shabbos and today, I'm just scratching the surface. And in the kollel they have to put up for me, I take a topic and I stay on it for a good few years. One has to know Shas and Poskim. You have to be a Talmud Chacham. And I'm fortunate I had Mori Rebbe Rav Soloveitchik for a Rebbe. It's a brilliant gift that I had. Once again, I thank the dummies in Tel Aviv in 1935 who didn't elect them chief rabbi. And as I mentioned to Rabbi Ganak, ask him how his uncle could make such a mistake. But you know what the answer is. In 35, the Rebbe was not known, and Rabbi Amiel was world famous. And everyone in Israel, they say to me, what would have been if the Rebbe became chief rabbi of Israel? It would have destroyed him. I say, you're a bunch of phonies. The Rebbe would have become like Rav Kook. Just as Israel influenced Rav Kook to become Rav Avraham Yitzchak HaKohen Kook, the Rebbe would have reacted to the challenge. It's mind-boggling who my Rebbe would have become. The man who gave the Drashen 56, Kol Dodi Dofei, which is unequaled until this very moment. Oh, but I wouldn't be sitting here, so take your choice. So what did he say? We try to discuss Minhag, we scratch the surface, but one thing is for sure, it's much harder to define Minhag than to define a Gezerah, to define a Takana. One has to be very careful in empowering the Jewish people. When you count Kohn Kerry among the people you're empowering to determine the future of the Torah people, we are in trouble. You have to define Torah by those who care and are observant and know how to differentiate, how to put a mechitza between the Jew as a ger and the Jew as a toshav. And this is the secret, this is the secret of our survival. Solomon Schechter had the best of intentions. Who would believe what came out of the theory Catholic Israel as it was practiced after his death, and what has happened until today? I can tell you that I davened every morning for about 30 years until he died. Professor Dov Zlotnik of the seminary, I trust you've heard the name, the ignorant should pass for the wise, make believe you did. Dov Zlotnik was the Talmud Mufak of Professor Shaul Lieberman. A fabulous, fabulous individual. What a family he raised. His daughter just did a doctorate in Bar Ilan on furniture at the time of the Talmud. It's available. The doctorate was published. What wonderful, from children, learned. And he was heartbroken. Oh, he couldn't talk about the seminary. What had happened from the time he entered as a student to what happened once Professor Liebman died. So we have to be very careful and we have to understand this distinction.
Can I have a copy of the new volume? Baruch atah Adonai Eloheinu Melech Haolam
she'hakol nehiyah
bedvaro. Amen.
I've been privileged to publish many volumes. And many of my volumes have gone through 4 editions, 5 printings. A lot has been cited, but it leaves me very unhappy because I'm always introduced as an author. I mean, I'm a melamed. Anything I authored is a fallout of being a teacher of Torah. Secondly, I'm introduced as a historian, which the Rav caused a tremendous problem because when my second volume came out in Reb Lazer Silva, and I did not yet know the Rav's relation with Reb Lazer, I only established that relationship when I do the research for my 2 volumes on Moriu Rebbe. So the Rav turned to his Mishrasim and said, Rabbi Rotkoff is my historian. And he praised the work on Silva. Now, I'm introduced as a historian. That's a sideshow. My life is Shas and Paiskim. So for the first time, I'm coming to the public on the 2 most difficult topics in Halacha. Classic Aguna, where you have to paskin on the basis of not knowing the facts. If you have a body, there's no Shaila. But when you don't have a body, how can you permit the woman to remarry? And of course, the mamzeret issue, which here you have a child, his mother committed adultery or committed incest, why should the child suffer? This volume was made possible, because I'm very busy, those of you who know in the Kollel, some of you listen, so you know I haven't repeated a lecture since the Kollel began in 78. All these lectures are self-constructed. I have hundreds of thousands of pages of notes of Kiddushim, etc. Many years ago, my revered colleague, a young man who's a Gaon and will one day take over the Kollel, Rabbi Asaf Bednash, I trust some of you know who I'm talking about, came to me and said, my old Chavruta would like to contact you. So a fellow named Jacob Weinstein contacted me, a PhD from MIT, works in Princeton, Hasmicha. And he asked me, Rebbe, I've been listening, there were tapes circulating of my shirm, I've been listening to you, and now I hear you on the YU website, would you mind if I produce all the sources you quote outside of Shas and Paiskim and make it an appendix on the website to your lectures? I said, fine, and he produced thousands of pages of sources that I quote. And then he asked, would you mind if I write up some of the shayla? Now, he was about the third or fourth person to ask me, and I always say yes, And the other three disappeared. They started writing too difficult. What you see here, the first draft was done by Rabbi Dr. Yaakov Weinstein. I had to work on it, you know, to bring it up to my level of what I consider a good English. Had to check everything, challenge, work, rework. We worked on this together for, it must be at least 3 years. Now, with publishing, I've had some very bad experiences with very major publishers. Literally, I'll give you one example. The two volumes of the Rav have continued to sell until today. It's gone through many printings. Each printing gets worse. They make it cheaper and cheaper. They have more profit. It's beyond words what they do to an honest individual. Once Ktav sold out to Urim in Israel, for the last years, I've never gotten any royalties. Now, people come to me to sign books. It means they're selling. I think I told you I was at the OU. I thanked the person in charge. They sent me royalties. I said, I got to thank you. Sent me royalties. You're honest. It's beyond words. So thank God I'm older in life. My children are married. Everyone is out. And darf nicht umkommen to the royalties. So I want to do something good. And you all know that the Mossad, again, you can read my book or read the Mossad's book. I prefer you read the Mossad's book because then you have to deal with the question, would they lie? Would Rakefet lie writing it about himself? Could be. We're all Karam Adam, Karam Retzlach Smoch, as I'll say it. But the Mossad, I don't think they had any reason. Malk and I were flabbergasted when we came to the book launch. Everyone jumps on us. Atama kol chavim, you're the stars. Mossad has no reason to fawn over me, to be obsequious to me, and Halavai should live up to what they wrote about me. So you all know, I mentioned it in 1981 when I came back from Russia the first time, shattered my wife and myself. We helped organize a spiritual center for Russian Jewry that functions until today. So this is the third volume I have given to them to publish, and they did a beautiful, beautiful job. And I can tell you where it was printed in the Ukraine. And these are people that we've made from a Kehila that we've influenced. And there they have a big printing press. So ArtScroll outsources to China. We outsource to the Ukraine. And I want to introduce a young man who, born and bred in Manchester, his father, Chashev HaRav there. We have a connection, of course, my granddaughter-in-law is a granddaughter of a very Chashev HaRav from Manchester, Zichrono Livracha. Her uncle is the Posek of Montreal. It's the Unstoffer family. So I too have a Manchester connection today. And he wound up, this young man, Rabbi David Kufnis, wound up in Toronto working for NCSY, the OU. And after many years, married and wound up in your holy city of Teaneck. And he has been working for Shvut Ami now for a number of years, and I want to ask David to say a few words. Thank you very, very much for your attendance and your kind attention. No, leave it on. The world can hear. It's okay.
Thank you, Rabbi Kefet. Before the book signing begins, in just a few minutes, I just want to thank Congregation Bnei Shurn, especially Rabbi Rosansky, President Stephen Margulis, Norman Sohn, Lois Blumenfeld, Harold and Bryna Kaiser, for hosting Rabbi Rakefet and Malka over this wonderful weekend, and for giving Shvut Ami this opportunity today. We've had the privilege now of hearing four lectures from a respected Torah scholar, a prolific author, and a beloved master teacher who has inspired and educated thousands of students during his almost 58 years in the field. As Rabbi Kefet talked about today and over Shabbat, his experiences over 10 years working with the Mossad teaching Torah in Russia led him to become one of the founding board members of Shvut Ami, an organization that reconnects unaffiliated Jews from the former Soviet Union to Jewish life. You know, a lot of people don't realize that after the Iron Curtain fell in 1991, even though 1 million Russian Jews immigrated to Israel, but hundreds of thousands stayed behind in the FSU. 70 years of communist rule almost completely destroyed the Jewish soul, the Yiddishkeit of these people. And that effect is felt very much today in the FSU. I met recently with Natan Sharansky, probably one of the most famous former prisoners of Zion, who almost died during 12 years of hell and torture in Siberia. And he's now the chairman, of course, of the executive of the Jewish Agency in Israel. And he told me that even though there are no official numbers, but he estimates that the intermarriage rate today across the 15 countries of the former Soviet Union is between 80 and 90%. Here in the USA, it's 58%. In the former Soviet Union, it's between 80 and 90%, depending on which city. 80 to 90%? Do you know what that means? It means that the hundreds of thousands of Jews in the former Soviet Union today are in a critical state. 80 to 90% means that most of these Jews are children of intermarriages already. 80 to 90% means that if we don't reach out to them today, for many of them, it will be too late. If this was happening in the United States here today, everyone would be up in arms. 80 to 90% intermarriage rate, a critical situation, a crisis. The Jewish Federation would be raising hundreds of millions of dollars to mobilize, to find these lost Jews, to reach out to them, to bring them back, and to give them another chance. And this would become the new agenda of the international Jewish community. But for the Jews in the former Soviet Union, for some reason, it's out of sight, out of mind. They're so far away, I don't see them, I don't know any Russian Jews. People actually say, well, they chose to stay behind. They could have gone to Israel, but they chose to stay behind. It's their choice. So what do you want from me? By the way, that reminds me of what Elie Wiesel once said. You know, Shvut Ami had the great honor to have Elie Wiesel as our honorary chairman for over 30 years until he passed away recently. I'm sure you know he wrote a famous book about the Jews in the Soviet Union called Jews of Silence. And he once said, I quote, "What torments me the most is not the Jews of silence I met in Russia, but the silence of the Jews I live among today." Can we really turn our backs on the most spiritually needy Jews in the world just like that because they couldn't afford the trip, or because they didn't want to uproot their life and start again, or because they're so assimilated and they've fallen so far that they just can't get up? Rabbi Matisyahu Solomon, the British-born, world-renowned Torah scholar and Jewish leader, who today is one of the heads of the Lakewood Yeshiva, probably the largest yeshiva in the world. They have 7,000 students, about 250 staff. Up until just recently, he used to travel often to the former Soviet Union to teach. He's not so well now. He had to cut down a lot. But he was asked in a newspaper interview, why, if there are so many estranged Jews here in the United States, why do you spend so much time traveling to Russia to help the Jews there? And he said, that's exactly why I do it, because I want people to notice and to ask that question. And the answer is that, of course, we have to help our assimilated brothers and sisters who live here. But there is a big difference between them and between the Jews of the former Soviet Union. The Jews here in the USA, he said, have always had so many choices and so many opportunities to be Jewish and to live a Jewish life. There are shuls and clubs and federations and Jewish student unions and NCSY and singles events. But the Jews of the former Soviet Union never had a choice. They never had a chance. Their Yiddishkeit was forcefully taken against their will. And so we have a bigger responsibility towards them and to help them. Of course we have to help our local brothers and sisters, but reaching out to assimilated Jews in the FSU is a priority. Recently I saw him, I know him from England. He recently had a stroke, he's in a wheelchair now. We discussed this topic again, and he took my hand and he said, "David, it's a priority." And over the last 25 years, Shvut Ami in Israel has trained over 160 Russian Jews to go back to the former Soviet Union and to help rebuild Jewish communities over there. Today, Shvut Ami provides staff, programs and resources for almost every organization that's out there, and our large team of graduates and emissaries are helping to educate and inspire thousands of Russian Jews. Given all this, I don't need to tell you that Shvut Ami is Rabbi Rakefet's favorite tzedakah. In fact, and I don't think he would want me to say this actually, but someone like Rabbi Rakefet, who has taught thousands of people over the years in many different institutions, many different settings, he gets people coming up to him all the time, former students, current students, people who are very positively affected by his lectures, by his advice, and it has changed their lives, people who owe everything to him, and they come up to him and they say, Rabbi Rakefet, I want you to have this gift. Or they say, I want to write out a check to you, do whatever you want with it. Or they say, here you've had a very positive influence on my life or on one of my children's lives. I know you don't have a lot, this is for you. And without fail, he says, I can't take it myself, but would you mind if I gave it to a great cause, to my cause, to Shvut Ami? He won't take a penny for himself, but he knows how Shvut Ami will put it to great use, helping the desperate Jews in the former Soviet Union. That is Rabbi Rakefet. Rabbi Rakefet has spent a tremendous amount of time and effort over the last 3 years to produce his new book, Rakafot Aharon, Volume 3. And Yaakov Weinstein, who we're privileged to have with us today from East Brunswick, has also spent a huge amount of time over the last 3 years compiling and annotating the information in this book. Neither of them have taken any financial remuneration for this because they want 100% of the proceeds to go to Shvut Ami. Right now, there is an opportunity to partner with them in the critical and urgent work of Shvut Ami by making a generous donation today. Every amount is appreciated and will receive a full tax receipt. This book is not available in any store. It's not available on QVC or the shopping network. It's not even available on Amazon.com. And I should mention that some of Rabbi Rakefet's other books are in fact, obviously available on Amazon. But today, Rabbi Rakefet is giving away for free this book and will sign personally for you as a token of appreciation to anyone who makes a donation of $100 or more to Shvut Ami today. And Rabbi Rakefet asked me to mention, obviously if that amount is difficult for someone, please let me know, I'm sure we can work it out. We also have a few copies of Volume 1 and 2 as well, and they're also being made available today as thank you gifts. And more details about this special opportunity are on the sheets over there, so please take a look. And again, even if you don't want to take a book home, any donation today will be greatly appreciated, and you will receive a full tax receipt. Thank you for listening, everybody. Have a great day.
I just want to make one addendum that we are Shvut Ami. We're more Litvish. I have to say that with all, intellectual honesty, Chabad is also doing great things in Russia. So you have to be aware. We're not the only players in the field, but there are people that will come to us who will not go to Chabad. I don't have to elaborate. It depends on the individual, the psychological makeup, his intellectual stance. So we're doing big things, but I have to give credit to Chabad. Putin is a Chabadnik, plain and simple. And those of you who understand what I'm saying, and you know what, I'll take one more minute. Do you know why Putin is a Chabadnik? Are you aware what Putin has done for Chabad with the manuscripts, made it part of the Lenin Library, built a special... visited Israel, and he was very upset that his third grade Jewish teacher, who had such a big influence on him, was living in he didn't like the apartment in South Tel Aviv. He visited her, and he gave an order to his aide-de-camp, before he leaves, he wants a signed document that they bought, the Russian government bought an apartment for her in North Tel Aviv, which she did. It was in all the Israeli newspapers. What's the secret of Putin? And he spoke about this at the Congress of Federations in Russia. He broke down and cried. You can see him crying, actually. He says, we, Malk and I know, he grew up in Moscow. Under the communist regime, families shared apartments. You had one kitchen and a bedroom, this and that. His family, he was an only, his parents worked very hard. They were simple people. And the other part of the apartment was a professor from Moscow University, a Jew. So the lady, the mother, the Jewish lady, every day at 6 o'clock would ask her, when are your parents coming home? 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock, come, eat with us. Friday night, he described how they made Kiddush and how after eating, they would open up holy books that he later learned was the Talmud. And he said, this family made such an impression on him that he loves the Jewish people. And he broke down and cried. So that's Putin. Chabad owns him. But Shvatami has what to do. V'day l'chakim v'remisa. Thank you very, very much.
I do.
Okay. You understand?
I understand. I'll see you.